chapter 20. All right. Tip over. 2 Kings chapter 20, verse 1. Now in chapter 19, if you guys were here last week, what ended up happening was the Assyrians came. And remember, the Assyrians was that empire in Mesopotamia that started taking over all of Mesopotamia. And they were just wrecking everybody. They ended up actually taking the northern 10 tribes and dispersing them. And that's why the northern 10 tribes are called the lost tribes. We have no idea where they are. After they got dispersed, they got interbred with other peoples. And so now we have no idea. The southern two, they remained a people, but the northern 10 were dispersed. So they went in and they brought an army, about 185,000 people, to the gates of Jerusalem. And they had taken everything. They had basically taken every city in Judah except for Jerusalem. And they were outside of Jerusalem, and Hezekiah refused to surrender to them. And he ended up going into the temple with all the words. The king of the Assyrians, Sennacherib, he wrote this thing basically saying, you know, like, we're going to kill you. You know, your God is useless. You know, just surrender and everything will go fine. But if you fight, we're going to destroy you. You know, we're going to completely eradicate you. And so Hezekiah laid it out in the temple of the Lord, and God came and said, man, don't worry. Not a single arrow is going to be shot. Nothing's going to happen. You're going to be fine. And God sent the angel of the Lord, and we talked about that a little last week, who some believe when it refers to the angel of Yahweh in the Old Testament, sometimes it's an ordinary angel, but it could also be referring to a pre-incarnate version of Jesus. And if you guys want to talk more about that, I can talk a little bit with you later. But it's really cool if you get into like Old Testament theology and see, like, man, that you can really see the Trinity in the Old Testament is really cool. But anyway, so he sends out the angel, and he kills all the army, all 185,000 of them, just get wrecked. And if you look historically, the funny thing is that if you go to a secular history class, they will agree that Assyria came against Jerusalem, they will agree that the army failed to take Jerusalem, and that after that, the decline of the Assyrian Empire happened, and not too long after that, they got taken over by another empire. You guys knew who it was? Kevin?
What?
Who's the empire that took over the Assyrians?
I don't remember last week.
Babylonians. The Babylonians came in and took over them under Nebuchadnezzar. And again, if you guys take secular history, these are all real people, and you're going to talk about them in history class. In fact, when I was doing history class, when we were going over this section, I didn't read my book once. I read the Bible, and I got an A on my test. So it's pretty cool. But anyway, so that broke the back of the Assyrian Empire. Now, what secular history tells us is that, well, Jerusalem was really well fortified and they were able to withstand them. But logically, does that make any sense to you guys? The Assyrian military was able to take much better defended cities than this one. They took Samaria. If you studied ancient history, you know Samaria was much better defended than Jerusalem was. And yet they completely destroyed, they decimated Samaria. And they had a much bigger force against Jerusalem. And it's not that they just failed to take it. Their army got killed. If you guys know anything about warfare, you know if you're trying to take a siege position and you fail, your army doesn't die as a result. You just fail and you leave and you go home. So it doesn't make any sense that their army got defeated. But again, secular history, they have trouble with what happened. They don't know. They're just like, hey, we don't know. It could be, could not be, but whatever. So this is on the aftermath of this. So Israel, Judah is now safe. Assyria is deteriorating. And Israel is increasing. So they're getting all their land back in Judah. Okay? And Hezekiah, this faithful king, been faithful all of his life, he's about to be told some pretty bad news. And if you pick it up in verse 1, it says this. In those days, Hezekiah was sick and near death. And Isaiah the prophet, the son of Amos, went to him and said to him, thus says the Lord, set your house in order, for you shall die and not live. So here we kind of see something that's very true in the Bible, and it's unfortunate, but it's true. You know, you could be as faithful as you want, but death comes for everybody. And you could be as good a person as you want, death comes for everybody. But the riches of a Christian, what I pursue in my life, is not the here and now. In fact, if it was the here and now, Paul says, we are of all men to be most pitied. Most pitied. Not just kind of. We are to be most pitied among all men. You know, Priscilla mentioned taking up your cross. the idea that what Paul said in Galatians is, man, because of this, I have been crucified to the world, and the world has been crucified to me. Early Christians, how are they put to death usually? Crucifixion, right? So when Paul wrote that to the Galatians, do you have any idea how that affected them? That word crucifixion, which we've kind of romanticized because we think about Jesus, that's like cancer today. That would be like if I said that. This world has suffered cancer to me, and the world to me has suffered cancer. That puts up negative images in a lot of your minds because people in this room, me included, have suffered from that affliction. Like people in our lives have suffered from that affliction. So that's like, whoa, that's hardcore. When Paul wrote that, people reading it were like, man, I lost my brother to crucifixion. I lost my dad to crucifixion. That's a hardcore word. You know, he's saying, my flesh, as a result of Christ indwelling me, has suffered a violent and public death. I no longer live for myself. Everything that I thought was important is now unimportant for the gain that's in Jesus Christ. This life is not everything. In fact, this life to Paul was nothing. He said, man, I seek the treasure that's in the kingdom that's to come. That was his heart. And that's where a Christian's heart should be. Now, in the Old Testament, the people back then, they didn't have this understanding of heaven that we have today. There was a lot of theological debate about what happens to you after you die. If you read some of the Psalms, it's clear that David and Asaph and some other of the psalmists were absolutely convinced that they were going to be with God after they died. Okay, and that's where you get the Pharisees. Remember when Jesus was talking to them and the Sadducees? The Pharisees accepted the resurrection. The Sadducees denied it. And that's why they asked him, like, oh, man, if there's a woman and she's got seven husbands, then whose wife is she going to be in the kingdom? And Jesus had to answer them. And you get into that in your own time. But the basic thing was people didn't really understand what was going to happen after you died. So there was a thought that maybe you're just going to cease to exist. There was a thought you were going to go to comfort. There was a thought no one really knew. And the reason why God didn't really reveal it to him is because his salvation wasn't complete at that point. But it's been revealed to us. We know what's going to happen. Hezekiah is under this influence that this life is it. And he's like, man, things are going good. I don't want to lose what I have. So what he does, it says he turned his face toward the wall and prayed to the Lord, saying, remember now, O Lord, I pray, how I have walked before you in truth with a loyal heart and have done what is good in your sight. And Hezekiah wept bitterly. So you see Hezekiah, this man of faith, he kind of loses faith in God a little bit. Okay? What he did wasn't wrong. Okay? When you go through a situation like this, what he did was not wrong. But you're going to see that because of his heart towards it, what he did was wrong. His actions weren't wrong, but his heart was very wrong. What he was essentially saying is, God, you don't know best. I think I know better than you, and I need to live longer. My life needs to glorify you more, and I haven't accomplished what I need to accomplish on this earth, so I need to live longer. So he was crying to God over and over and over again, and God finally answers his prayer. Now, this is a very interesting part of the Bible, and it gets into deep theological stuff. And it happened before Isaiah had gone into the middle court that the word of the Lord came to him, saying, return and tell Hezekiah, the leader of my people, thus says the Lord, the God of David, your father, I have heard your prayer, I have seen your tears, surely I will heal you. On the third day you shall go up to the house of the Lord, and I will add to your days 15 years. I will deliver you from this city, from the hand of the king of Assyria, and I will defend this city for my own sake. For my own sake and for the sake of my servant David. This is very interesting because God was going to do something. Somebody prayed and he didn't do it. Okay? Now, is that always the case? Can I always pray and God's always going to answer in the way I want it? No. See, and this thing right here, because I think too much, I overthink everything, this situation right here led me to be like, well, I don't get it at all. Maybe I should never pray. Like a year ago, I was honestly in this funk where I was like, you know, if God already knows what I'm going to say, and he already has his mind made up, he already knows if he's going to listen to me or not, then why even pray? You know? And aren't I just like saying the stuff he already knows? And he has the ability to say no, right? So, I mean, like, it's kind of stupid for me to pray. And the way that God rebuked me was really cool. And I had just started teaching in the 4 and 5s. And I remember I just got done with a Bible study. I was like, hey, who wants to pray? And all the little kids, their hands shot up. And I'm like, okay, go and pray. And they were praying like some stuff. I was like, ah, that's a dumb prayer. They're like, oh, I thank you, God, for pizza and macaroni. And my sister's awesome. And I'm like, oh, that's such a lame prayer, man. And like, as I was just like praying, I just felt God just say to me, he's like, that little kid has a better prayer life than you do. Because at least he believes I'm hearing him. And I was like, ugh. That just like made me feel so crappy. I was like, man. And I was like, but God, I don't understand. And I read passages. I was like, you change your mind sometimes, but not always. I don't get it. Like, what? How does it work? And he's like, it's not for you to know. It's for you to trust me. I don't do the things that I do because I know everything. I don't pray because I fully understand God's sovereign will versus my free will. I don't know. I don't get it. But, you know, it would be a pretty insignificant God for someone as insignificant as me to fully understand his goings, right? Be pretty weak God, pretty non-intricate Lord, if you and your finite understanding and your, you know, the oldest person in this room is what, 30? 30? If in your 30 years you can understand an infinite God, that would be pretty pathetic. You know, that's why Isaiah in Isaiah 55, he says, my ways aren't your ways. My thoughts aren't your thoughts. For as the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways, and my thoughts higher than your thoughts. It's not for you to understand. It's for you to trust. If God says it, I trust that he knows better. You know, I'm just going to have to assume that God knows better than Peter does. And I'm going to have to surrender to him and trust in what he's doing. Now, there's another man in the Bible who didn't understand what God was doing, and so he complained against him, and that man's name was Job. And God, to answer Job, the very interesting thing, we're going to get into that book later. I hope I get into it because I like to bum you guys out. But when he goes and he answers Job, he doesn't tell him why he was doing the things he was doing. He wasn't like, Job, this is exactly why you're suffering. Satan came to me and I wanted to show the world my glory and showing them a servant who loves me for me. Not the things that I give you, but just simply for who I am. He didn't tell him that. Instead, he's just like, Job, are you God? Did you make the world? Did you start? And he goes on this huge rant for pages about all the things he does. And he's like, Job, can you, you know, keep all the constellations in order? Can you weigh the mountains in a scale? Can you judge? Can you? And he like just goes over and over. And he's like, and Job, like Hezekiah, doubted God's plan for salvation in death. And if you guys ever talk to Jehovah's Witness, they will quote Job. And they'll say, see, there's nothing after death. Job didn't understand. You know what God said to that? Have you been there? How do you know? Have you been there? He's like, I've been there. I'm kind of from there. And I know what's there. And you need to shut up and just trust me. He doesn't answer him. He just reveals to him his character. He says, you need to trust me. And at the end of all of it, Job is just like, you're God. It's essentially what he says, you're God. God doesn't restore him. God doesn't give him anything back. And Job just says, I love you for you. You're God. I trust you. And that was it. Then God restored him. It was after Job affirmed his faith, not before, that God restored him. I trust you. And because Job had faith, we have a book named after the guy. God's name was so glorified in this dude's life through his infirmities, not through his blessings. If he was just a rich guy who trusted God, guess what? We wouldn't have that book. There are tons of those dudes out there. There's nothing impressive about that at all. But because he had things taken from him and he still had faith, though you slay me, God, yet I will love you. The Lord giveth, the Lord taketh away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. And my faith, as fine as gold, will be tried through the fire and I will come forth as gold. That's what he said. These are beautiful words because he went through trial. You see, my point in all this is saying maybe the trial that you're going through is for your best, and maybe God knows that. So if you're wondering, man, why am I praying and why is it not getting answered? Maybe it's because God loves you too much to answer that prayer. Hezekiah, he was like, Hezekiah, you need to die, man. You've lived a good life. You've done good things, man. I've done amazing things through you. But this is your time. This is your time to pass and to come and be with me forever. Don't you want that? But Hezekiah said, no, God, I don't want that. I want to stay here. And he threw a tantrum. And God's like, all right, man, fine. I'll give you 15 extra years. But during those 15 years, one of the most righteous kings in all of southern Israel, one of the most righteous kings in all of Israel, probably in the world ever, fell on his face. If he would have just listened to God and trusted that God knew best, everything would have been fine. He would have died. And instead in your Bibles, what it was said has been Sennacherib was defeated. Hezekiah got sick. He died. Thus passed a really righteous king. And then boom, all we would know was the good things. But instead, his story goes on. And it gets really sad after this. Okay? That's why when you pray, that's why when Jesus prayed in the Garden of Gethsemane, what did he say? Nevertheless, not my will, but your will. It's not bad for you to pray for things because we only see through a glass darkly. We don't understand what's going on. And we may think, God, this really needs to happen. Okay? And it's not bad for you to do that, to trust in your Father and to cast your cares upon him because he cares for you. What's bad is when you assert your will over his. That's bad. Okay? And the worst thing that can happen is God does what he does to Hezekiah and says, okay, be careful what you wish for. And he gives it to you. That is the absolute worst thing that can happen to you. Hezekiah, probably looking back, was like, man, I really wish I didn't pray that. I really wish God just said no and was firm in it. And this is a little word of warning for you guys. You can resist the will of God in your life. You can. You have the ability to. God has two plans for your life. There is a chosen plan, and there's kind of a recessive plan. There's a plan that he will accept because he accepts your free will. It's not his best for you, but he'll accept it because he loves you and he wants to show you you have free will. You can do what you want. Jonah's perfect will was to go to Nineveh the first time. His recessive will was to have him swallowed by a whale. Okay? And his even, I believe, even deeper recessive will, if Jonah would never have like repented and humbled himself, his continued recessive will is he would have just killed Jonah. Jonah would have just died. That would have been it. You can push and push and push against God until he relents. And you'll say, okay, you don't want me, you don't want my plan, fine, let's see how it goes. And you'll see how it goes. See, because of our fear, I doubt that my Father has what's best for me. So in Romans 8:38, what does it say? Priscilla, that's your favorite verse. What does it say? Yeah, and what does it say after that? If he did not spare his only son, how will he not with him give us all things freely? If God was so interested in your betterment and your best is to be with Jesus, there's nothing higher than that. There's no one greater than Jesus. There's no pleasure greater than Jesus. There's no reward greater than Jesus. There's no joy greater than Jesus. His best for you is himself. And in order to get you that best, he was willing to die for it. He was willing to do all things to give it to you. He can't do anything beyond dying. That's it. That's the highest level he can do for you. If he was not going to spare his only son for your sake, don't you think that the things he's leading you into today are for your best? He was willing to be broken for you. See, why am I not willing to be broken for him? Maybe the fact that this ailment, maybe this thing that I'm facing right now that I don't understand that is breaking me and is destroying my strength, maybe that's what's best for me. Maybe I need to be weak so that God's strength can be manifest in my life. Maybe I need to be battling this sin day in and day out and seeing more failure than victory. Maybe that's what I need to grow and to understand God's purpose for my life. Maybe he needs to show me these relationships that I don't understand so that I can grow in love and in knowledge with him. Maybe I need these people in my life who don't trust God and who are constantly hurting me with their words. And even though I love them so much, they don't see the truth. Maybe that's what's best for me, that I can learn to trust God in all things. See, maybe that's what's the best thing for you to do. Maybe it's best. I mean, why did God take my mom, my dad, my brother, my sister at that time in their life? Maybe that was what was best for them. Because maybe if they kept living, things would have gotten a lot worse for them. Why has God allowed this? I don't know. I don't know. I don't claim to know. Because God's ways are higher than my ways and his thoughts are higher than my thoughts. The only thing that I trust in is that he knows best. And I'm going to hang everything on that. And the best definition of faith I've ever heard was actually from Scott. It was an acronym, forsaking all, I trust him. If you want to be well-pleasing to God, you have to be strong in faith. That's what pleases God. That's your love language towards your Creator. Because you can't see him, you can't feel him, you can't touch him. That's how you learn how to love him more and more. Faith is the most important thing that God could ever instill inside of you. And I will gladly go through many, many trials to refine my faith, to be pleasing to my Father. He's all that matters to me now. And I've gone through a lot of crap this last year. And all of it, man, I wouldn't trade any of it for the world. All the pain that I went through, all the trials, all the uncertainties, all the not knowing, all the nights staying up and just praying and praying and not understanding, I wouldn't trade them for anything. I am so thankful that God didn't answer some of my prayers. And because through it all, he has shown me better things if I just trust him. We are to be like well-trained horses, man. Just like when God yanks on the reins just a little bit, you should turn. That's what we're trying to get to, where we just turn. But are any of us like that? No. We yank the other direction and we go this way. And so he's got to really yank on it and he's got to like damage us. He doesn't want to. But you're so stubborn, you don't see that he has what's best for you. You're so foolish, you don't see, man, God has what's best for me. And the next time you get in that funk of just being like, man, I don't know what's going on, blah, 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 I encourage you to do what I did and read the end of Job and just let the conviction just wash over you. Like, no, I didn't create the earth, God. I didn't do any of that. Yeah, you're right. And so then you just trust him. You just stop and you just trust him. And, but anyway, going on to this sad story. And if you guys, like I've been talking about in this study, Isaiah parallels this, okay? And so a lot of people think that Isaiah, whoever wrote 2 Kings, was heavily influenced by the book of Isaiah. They were probably using it for a reference. Because if you read these two close together, they parallel each other very well. You go to 2 Chronicles, that's a different author. And so it's different. It's the same story. They're just like different things emphasized in it. But anyway, it goes on. And I will add to your days 15 years, and I will deliver you in the city from the hand of the king of the Assyrians, and I will deliver the city for my own sake, for the sake of my servant David. Then Isaiah said, take a lump of figs. And they took it and laid it on the boil, and he recovered. And Hezekiah said to Isaiah, what is the sign that the Lord will heal me? And then I shall go up to the house of the Lord on the third day. And Isaiah said, this is the sign to you from the Lord, that the Lord will do the thing which he has spoken. Shall the shadow go forward 10 degrees or backward 10 degrees? Hezekiah answered, it is an easy thing for the shadow to go down 10 degrees. No, let the shadow go backward 10 degrees. So Isaiah the prophet cried out to the Lord, and he brought the shadow 10 degrees backwards, by which it had gone down on the sundial of Ahaz. So God is just so awesome. God is just so awesome. Could easily just been like, are you kidding me? I just killed 185,000 people. You really need my word that I'm going to do this? All right. Like, he could have done it, but he was just like, okay, fine. What do you want? I'm going to give you a miracle. I'm going to show you a miracle. And in fact, I'm going to let you choose the miracle in order to reaffirm your faith in me, if this is what you need. If you experience miracles in your life, and I've had some happen to me, and they've been really cool, but that's not why I believe in God. God would prefer you have faith in him without miracles. That's what his preferred method in your life would be, that you have faith devoid of miracles. But if you need a miracle, he'll give it to you. If it is absolutely necessary to you, and he will discern when it is necessary for you, if it is absolutely necessary for you in your walk with him for a miracle to happen, he will give it to you. But every single time I could look back at my life and I see a miracle happened, it was a rebuke to me because I was being faithless. I was like, fine, I'll show you something miraculous. Boom. And I was like, oh, man. Okay. And then I was back on track. But if I would be doing the things that he wanted me to do, then I wouldn't have needed a miracle in the first place. So he does something really cool for Hezekiah. He actually rewinds the clock 10 degrees. I don't know how much that on the rotation of the earth that would be, but it rewinds it 10 degrees. Okay. How did that happen? I don't know. A lot of proponents against the Bible are like, whoa, see, like God couldn't have possibly done that because if he spun the earth the other way, then, you know, we would have all flown off. And they have like all these charts and diagrams and all this crap. Like, okay, if you believe Genesis 1, that God, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth, this isn't that big a deal. So, I mean, I believe in an almighty God, so your point is stupid. Anyway, going on to verse 12. At the time of Berodach, Baladan, the son of Baladan, king of Babylon, sent letters and a present to Hezekiah, for he heard that Hezekiah had been sick. Hezekiah was attentive to them and showed them all the house of his treasures, the silver and gold, the spices of the precious ointment, and all of his armory. All that was found among his treasures. There was nothing in his house or in all of his dominion that Hezekiah did not show them. Now, when you read that, it doesn't sound bad. It doesn't sound like he did a bad thing. But if you go in 2 Chronicles to the parallel of this passage, it says something interesting. This is 2 Chronicles verse 32. And it says, in those days Hezekiah was sick near to death, and he prayed to the Lord, and he spoke to him and gave him a sign. But Hezekiah did not repay according to the favor shown him, for his heart was lifted up. Once again, you see, the thing that he did wasn't wrong. It was his heart behind what he was doing. God gave him a healing. So you want a healing? Here's a healing. You want a miracle? Here's a miracle. Now, my response to that should be, man, God, you're everything. Now I'm just going to praise you for the rest of my days. I want to be humbled before you. But instead, Hezekiah was lifted up. Man, I could change the mind of God. I'm a pretty righteous dude. And look at all the stuff I have. Man, I'm so awesome. And this, my stuff is just so big and awesome. You ever like pray? And it's funny, I watch TV shows like this, and it makes me laugh because, you know, even though they're secular and they don't actually believe in God, it kind of reminds me of myself. And they'll like, a character in the show or whatever will like get down, they'll be like, God, if you just do this, I'll serve you for the rest of my life. And they'll go into this prayer, and then like right after they're done praying, like whatever they prayed for gets answered, and they're like, oh, never mind, it happened anyway. And they go, they don't glorify that God did it. They're just like, oh, never mind, God. And then just go on. And like, I laugh at that, but it's like, I've done the same things. Sometimes I've spent like months praying for a friend or something. God, just let them see the light, man. Just let them see you. And then it happens. And it's just like, I don't glorify God in it at all. I'm not like, God, man, you're so good. You did what I prayed. I'm just like, oh, okay, that's cool. And I go on with my life and I just cross it off my prayer list. I don't really think about it. I don't really glorify God for what he did. I just think, oh, it's cool that happened. You know? See, our response to God should reflect what he did for us. That's why in Romans 12, it says we should be living sacrifices, for it is our reasonable service unto God. It's a reasonable service. What Paul is saying is, it's reasonable that you should give your everything to God, that you should daily pick up your cross and follow him, saying, everything to me is crucified because you were crucified for me. God, you gave everything to save me, worthless, sinful me. Isn't it my reasonable sacrifice to do the same for him? Isn't it reasonable that God, man, humbled himself and went and answered Hezekiah's prayer? Isn't it reasonable that Hezekiah would give him all the glory for the rest of his life, but he doesn't? And his motivation behind this, as you can see from the 2 Corinthians passage and what happens next, his motivation was not like, oh man, I'm better and God's good. But he's like, oh man, look at all this stuff that I have and everything. And he's showing them the armories and the gold and silver. And if you know anything about history, you know why he did it. See, Babylon at this time was not an empire. Babylon at this time was a conquered province. They were not powerful at all. This dude came and Hezekiah was basically like, yeah, man, beat the Assyrians, did all this. Look at how awesome I am. Showed him everything. He's like, man, I'm just good. You know, I'm such a good king. And the guy left. Notice what happens after he leaves, though. Verse 16. Then Isaiah the prophet went to King Hezekiah and said to him, what did these men say and from where did they come? Hezekiah said, they came from a far country, from Babylon. And he said, what have they seen in your house? And Hezekiah answered, they have seen all that is in my house. There's nothing among my treasures that I have not shown them. Then Isaiah said to Hezekiah, hear the word of the Lord. Behold, the days are coming. All that is in your house and that your fathers have accumulated until this day shall be carried into Babylon. Nothing shall be left, says the Lord. And they shall take away from some of your sons who will descend from you, whom you will beget. And they will be eunuchs in the palace of the king of Babylon. You guys know what a eunuch is? Castration. Yeah, that's right. If you ever read the book about Daniel, Daniel was a eunuch. Daniel was the fulfillment of this prophecy. He was one of the houses of Hezekiah. He was one of the best, the brightest. He was taken, and they castrated him. and then made him serve them forever. See, the things you do, as much as you would like to believe they're only affecting you, do not only affect you. They affect everybody in your life. See, your sin isn't just about you. My sin isn't just, well, this is my little sin, and only I'm going to suffer. Everybody suffers as a result of your little sin. See, the example that you're supposed to be to others, the way that you're supposed to treat those that God has put inside of your life to be most precious to you because they're so precious to Him, it's going to affect your relationship with them because you have secret sin that you're not willing to confess or you're not willing to deal with in the way that God wants you to deal with it. You see, it's going to affect you. It's going to affect your kids. And you see, the sin was in Hezekiah's life. His son was one of the biggest creeps to sit on the throne of Judah. See, your sin affects more than you can even comprehend. That's why God calls you out of it. He doesn't want you to suffer, and He doesn't want the people around you to suffer. See, in Galatians 6, it says, God is not mocked. Whatever you sow, you will reap. You sow to the flesh, you will from the flesh reap corruption. I can't sow to my flesh, sow to lust, sow to lust, sow to lust, sow to lust, and expect to reap love. That'd be stupid. That'd be like me throwing weed seeds inside of a field and expecting to get corn or something like that. It's foolishness. It's not going to work. If I throw it in the field, what do you think is going to grow up? The weeds that I planted. Man, if you're sowing to your lust today, guess what you're going to reap in a year? Lust and destruction. And that's what I reaped for years. I'm still suffering from the consequences of my decisions when I was your age. Still, in my heart, suffering for what I did. I still battle the strongholds daily that I set up in my own heart against God. Because I was like, I think I know better. This sin's so much fun, though. And pornography's just so good. But it wasn't. You know? And again, it affected everybody around me. And so Hezekiah, you're like, you're going to sow to pride, you're going to sow to pride, you're going to sow to pride. Well, you're going to reap destruction and calamity, not just for you, but for everyone after you. You think your life is all about you. You think that when you die, man, the movie ends and the credits roll. That's what you think because you prayed so passionately to me that I keep you alive because it's so important that you're alive. And you think when you close your eyes, the world stops spinning. That's how arrogant you are. Well, you're going to see that your actions have consequences that resound after your death. After your death, guess what? The story keeps going. And people are going to remember the name of Hezekiah. Not for good. That's sad. That's sad when pride gets lifted up in your heart, when you think your life is all about you. It's all about me. My sin's all about me, and my life is all about me, and it doesn't really matter who I affect or who I hurt. It's all about me. And you're going to live like that. And then when those people who care most about you have to deal with the fallout of your decisions, you're going to take it for granted, and you're going to hurt them again. Because you never got it. You never got it. It took my cousin 3 times to overdose on heroin before she realized, maybe I'm affecting someone other than myself. Maybe it hurts my sister when she sees me overdosed on the floor. Maybe it hurts my father when he has to resuscitate me. Maybe it hurts my mother when she hears these stories, when I call her wasted. Maybe it hurts them. Maybe, just maybe. But you're so arrogant you don't see it. Your sin affects other people. But Hezekiah does something really cool. He does something really cool. In verse 19 he says, "So Hezekiah said to Isaiah, 'The word of the Lord which you have spoken is good.' For he said, 'Will there not be peace and truth, at least in my days?'" Hezekiah humbled himself. And God granted him forgiveness. He granted him forgiveness. He's like, okay, these things are not going to happen in your time. And they're not going to be dependent on you anymore. They're going to be dependent on what your descendants do. And the descendants just chose to go away from God, so the judgment did happen. But he forgave Hezekiah. Remember, Hezekiah was so untrusting of God in the beginning of this chapter that when he was dying, he's like, man, God, you got to do something, man, or else haven't I served you? Haven't I? And he goes in this whole, and you go in Isaiah, you see his full prayer, even after he was healed. And he's just all bummed out. Now he's hearing the worst possible news. The biggest thing that he could think to lose, his legacy, has been stripped from him. And he goes, okay, God's good. And I trust that this is for my best. And if this is what has to happen, then it's going to happen. And remember this, to whom much is given, much is required. God was harsh against Hezekiah because Hezekiah was given much. a lot of signs, a lot of miracles, a lot of chances were given to Hezekiah, and a lot of power, authority, and wealth, privilege, everything was given to Hezekiah. Things that the other people of Israel didn't have. He had the law. Most of the other people didn't have the law. Too much is given, much is required. What do you think is required of you? We have the fullness of scriptures right here. How hard is it to buy a Bible? If I lost my Bible today, do you think I would have a real hard time getting a new one? How hard is it for me to search the truth, to go on the internet and find out what things are really true? To really search and be like, man, is Jehovah's Witness right? Is Mormon? Is it really hard for me to do that? No? How hard is it for someone in a little town in India to figure those things out? How hard is it for them to get a Bible? For them to pray? To have a church service like this one? How much do you think is required of you for what has been given to you? We are privileged and blessed. Do you glorify God for those privileges and those blessings? Or do you think that it's just something that you earned? You're entitled to it. Too much is given, much is required. You should always remember that. Now the rest of the acts of Hezekiah and all that he did, and how he made a pool and a tunnel, brought water into the city, are they not written in the chronicles of the kings of Judah? So Hezekiah rested with his fathers. Then Manasseh, his son, reigned in his place. Hezekiah did this really cool architectural thingamajigger. It was really cool. He actually created a tunnel that went all through Jerusalem and fresh water that flowed under it, so that if they were ever sieged, that he would have fresh water always. And the really cool thing is, I think Tom mentioned that when he did Time with Tom, they actually started on two different ends, and they met in the middle. Isn't that crazy? And they didn't have technology. They didn't have like seismographs being like, oh, they're right there. Dude, you just had dudes with pickaxes going like, I think they're this way. And then just like, and they found each other. Isn't that crazy? Man, ancient man was so smart, dude. We're so dumb nowadays. Can't do anything without technology. Oh, awesome. Awesome. Yeah, and if you go to Jerusalem today, you can find the Tunnel of Hezekiah. You can go into it, and it's pretty cool. And it's made for, like, I think a 4-foot tall person or something like that. So it's going to be kind of uncomfortable, but you can go. Now listen to this. This is important. Manasseh was 12 years old when he became king, and he reigned 55 years. How long was Hezekiah's life extended? 15 years. How old was Manasseh when he began to rule? So when was Manasseh born? 3 years into his extended life. If Hezekiah would have died when God said it was good for him to die, Manasseh would have never been born. And the carnage that comes as a result of this kid being born would have never happened. It would never happen. If you read the book of Isaiah, Isaiah's historical part of his book ends when Hezekiah dies. It ends. Now, when I say tradition, what I mean is this is what's been carried on orally. It's not canon. In other words, it's not the word of God. But in tradition, it said that Isaiah was sawn in half by Manasseh. Okay? That's a pretty gruesome way to die. We do know from this chapter that Manasseh does kill a lot of innocent people. A lot of innocent people die as a result of this dude. Okay? Isaiah very well may have been one of them, because he probably was the first one in line to say, dude, you're wrong. And Manasseh probably didn't like it. 12-year-old kid with all the power in the world. If you... Those of you who have younger brothers and sisters and things like that who are at the age of 12, imagine giving them a nation at that age. You have ultimate authority, man. You're going to be, you're king, dude. You can do whatever. How do you think they would respond to that amount of power? Probably not well, right? So you got this 12-year-old kid with ultimate power. Somebody comes into his kingdom and says, hey, dude, you're jacked up. What's he going to do? Off with his head, right? Or saw him in half, you know? So this dude most likely killed Isaiah. We don't know, but most likely he did. We do know in Hebrews 11, verse 37, it does talk about some of the prophets getting sawn in half. And that's a pretty radical way to die. That would not be over quickly. Anyway. Anyway, it goes on. Verse 2. Hey, Bo! No. Okay. The verse 2. He did evil in the sight of the Lord according to the abominations of the nations whom the Lord had cast out before the children of Israel. He rebuilt the high places, which Hezekiah his father had destroyed. He raised up altars for Baal and made wooden image, as Ahab, king of Israel, had done. He worshipped all the hosts of heaven and served them. He also built altars in the name in the house of the Lord, of which the Lord had said, in Jerusalem I will put my name. And he built altars for all the hosts of heaven in the two courts of the house of the Lord. Also he made his son pass through the fire, practiced soothsaying, used witchcraft, consulted spiritists and mediums. He did much evil in the sight of the Lord to provoke him to anger. He even set a carved image of Asherah that he had made in the house of which the Lord had said to David and to Solomon his son, "In this house and in Jerusalem, which I have spoken out of all tribes of Israel, I will put my name forever. And I will not make the feet of Israel wander any more from the land which I gave their fathers, only if they are careful to do according to all that I have commanded them, and according to all the law my servant Moses commanded them." But they paid no attention, and Manasseh seduced them to do more evil than the nations whom the Lord had destroyed before the children of Israel. So this guy, he comes into the temple, and he starts putting up idols in the temple. In the temple. Goes into the house of God, and he starts setting up stuff. It'd be like if we took those big screens and we start just busting porn on them all the time. It'd be crazy, right? Be like, whoa, you know, that's different. That's a weird church service. And Scott came in and just started doing, you know, bong loads or whatever. And it's like, be like, whoa, you know, this is wacko. Like, this is what's happening. And when we read stuff like this in the Bible, we're just like, well, it kind of sickens you, doesn't it? When you had like a picture of someone coming into the temple, because you're like, man, that temple of God is so holy. And this guy's going to come in here bringing these defamed things in there. And there you're just like, oh, it kind of makes you angry. We're going to hear about Antiochus Epiphany. When he came in, he was one of the Greek generals. We're going to get to him in Daniel. That's going to be a cool study. But anyway, he went into the temple, took a pig, slaughtered it in the temple. And Jewish people aren't really too big on pigs. Slaughtered it in the Jewish temple and worshipped Zeus in the spot of God. Now we hear that, we're like, whoa, dude, that is hardcore, man. Those dudes are so gnarly, man. Like, man, God should just wipe them out. Or just, you know, it kind of like makes us cringe a little bit just listening to it. We talked about this a little bit last week, and we mentioned it today. The temple of the Lord, the official dwelling place of Jesus now, is not in Jerusalem. It's in you. And it's in me. I am the temple of the Lord. And so it should sicken me just as much when anything profane enters my body. When I do anything profane to service of another god, whether it be an idol of myself, an idol of pornography, the idol of drug abuse, the idol of alcohol, the idol of whatever, you go down the list, whatever idol that you may be worshiping, it should offend you just as much to hear that happening. You have been made holy, blameless, without spot, because of the blood of Jesus Christ sanctified you. And read Colossians 1:22. And when you're reading these passages, I hope when you go to the New Testament now and you read them talking about sprinkling and becoming the temple of the Lord and all these things, your mind goes back to the Old Testament and you remember why these guys are using the language that they're using. You are that level of holy. To a Jew, to hear that, that's hardcore. Dude, for a Jew to even think about the Holy of Holies, they're like, dude, I've never even set foot in the Holy of Holies. And if I set foot in there, I get struck dead. And for Paul to write something like, dude, you're the Holy of Holies now. You're like, whoa. The Spirit of God dwells in me. I am one with Him, just as He is one with me. That is insane. It should blow your mind. You know, but Manasseh didn't do it. And the cool thing about God is He never just judges someone. Never just does it. It's like, oh, you don't know why you're doing it. Boom, and just drops a hammer on you. He gives you every chance to turn back. And when you're in the midst of the judgment, you're going to know why it's happening. Israel, when the commentator of this, he's like, dude, this is what happened. In the house of Jerusalem, which I have chosen, tribes of Israel, I will put my name forever. I will not make the feet of Israel wander any more from the land which I gave their fathers, only if they are careful to do according to all that I have commanded them and according to the law of Moses, my servant. See, God showed them what is right. He showed them the right thing to do. He showed them how to have a blessed life. He showed them how to obey Him and how to serve Him in the best way, just as He has shown you how to serve Him in the best way. When you don't, and you go through trials, when you go through, like, man, why is the presence of God leaving me? Why is my prayer life just sucking nowadays? And man, why do I feel so bummed when I'm in church nowadays? And why is this? Why is that? Just search your heart. You're going to find why really quickly. You're going to see the hypocrisy that's in your life. You're going to see how you've been playing the harlot. And you're going to have no one to blame but yourself. And that's going to hurt you worse than anything. See, when I was looking at people getting blessed around me, when I was in the church doing my whole thing, and I looked holy, and everyone else was just like, man, that dude has an on-fire life with Jesus. And I would look at them and be like, dude, why am I on the outside looking in on that guy? Well, I've been in the church my whole life. That dude just got saved, and he's having this amazing relationship with Jesus. Why? It didn't take me long. It didn't take me long to realize. Maybe it's because I'm going to go home tonight and view pornography. Maybe that has something to do with it, you know? Probably. Why is this happening to me? Because I'm a sinner and I'm fallen. Why do I feel bummed out today? Maybe it's because I'm being jealous against people in my life. Man, why do I not trust in God? Maybe it's because I'm struggling with faithlessness because pride has ebbed its way inside my life again and I think I know better than God again. And why do I feel so bummed? Man, that's why. And it's so easy to see for me now that when I go through, I'm like, dude, what is wrong with me? And there's a psalm, I think it's Psalm 42, but the guy in the psalm is actually talking to himself throughout the psalm. He goes like, man, why are you downcast, oh my soul? Why are you, man, like it would be like me standing here, man, why am I bummed out? Man, heart, why are you so hurting right now? And I would just be talking to myself like that, you know? And the reason is because he knew, trust in God. That's what he says after that, trust in God. Why am I bummed out? Because I'm not trusting in God. And I need to go back. I need to go back to my first love. I need to remember that He has what's best for me. I need to start reading Romans 8:38 again. I need to start reading Philippians 1 that says, He who began a good work in me will be faithful to complete it until the day of Christ Jesus. I need to remember that. Man, I keep failing. Well, He told me. He's not to give up on me. He told me in Ephesians 2 that I am His workmanship, His masterpiece, created for good works. And I need to remember those passages and be like, dude, no, this is wrong. This guilt and shame I'm feeling is wrong. And this bummer attitude that I have is wrong. And it's not glorifying to God. It's all self-seeking. I need to reject it. I need to get in prayer. And I need to start telling people. I need to call up friends and be like, man, dude, I need you to pray for me. So I'm screwing up right now. You know? Stuff was happening to me last week. Like, literally last week, just bummed. And I had to talk to people. I had to talk to Caleb and Bo and just be like, dude, I suck. I'm wicked. I need help. You know, and I hope you guys have people like that in your life that you can do, that you could do that with. You can pray. Even if it's just a text. Hey, can you just pray for me? That's it. Just pray for me. And I'm going to trust that God's going to take care of me. That's it. Prayer's out there. I know it's powerful. I know it's awesome. I'm going to trust. You know? And verse 10 says, and the Lord spoke by His servants, the prophets, saying, because Manasseh, king of Judah, has done these abominations, he acted more wickedly than all the Amorites who were before him, and has also made Judah sin with his idols. Therefore, thus says the Lord God of Israel, behold, I am bringing such a calamity upon Jerusalem and Judah that whoever hears of it, both his ears will tingle. I will stretch over Jerusalem the measuring line of Samaria and Plumna. I'm sorry, I just got this funny image. Like when he said that, like the thing is going to be so hardcore that even the people that hear of it, their ears will tingle. Kind of remember me of like an insult on the playground, just like, dude, I'm going to beat you so bad your mom's going to feel it. Or whatever. Like, you know, like that's kind of what's happening here. Like, dude, you guys are going to get so worked that everyone even hears it. It's going to be like, whoa, dude, Israel got really jacked up, dude. Like, so, but again, like, it's basically the prophets are coming and saying, judgment's not going to happen. Because of what you've done, judgment's going to happen. And when we read this story, we're kind of like, well, that's kind of not fair. Because Manasseh's the one been leading it. Shouldn't God just judge Manasseh? But you have to understand, God, when He tells history, God is a very personal God. He's a very personal God. He could easily write this like a history book, but He doesn't. He wants to show you how He works in the world. And He works through people. So what He does is He narrows in on a life. And you want to know what's happening in the history when the Medo-Persians are over there and King Darius is reading? Oh, well, let's talk about Esther. She lived then. And He goes through. He's like, man, I love that girl. And He goes through her life. And you want to know what's happening during the time of Judges? Well, let's talk about Ruth. Let's talk about Gideon. Let's talk about Samson. And God tells you about the people that He's using and the people that He is moving to glorify His name in beautiful ways. That's why He tells history the way He does, because He cares about people. And He uses people to do His will and His good purpose, and He's going to use you to do amazing things. That's why in Ephesians 3 it says, you pray to Him who's able to do exceedingly and abundantly above all that you can ever ask or pray. Because you ask and you pray for things that are too small. Like, God, I just want to get through this. God, I just want to get through high school. If you only knew the plans and purposes that God had for you. And I thought I wasn't even going to be alive much longer after high school, honestly. But dude, God has done amazing things in my life. He does exceedingly and abundantly above anything I could ask or pray for. You know, that's the beauty of Jesus. And He uses people just as fallen as we are. That's why it says in 2 Corinthians 1, and He's using the weak things of the world to put to shame the things that are strong. And the things that are abased and of no report to put to shame the things that are. So that no flesh glories in His presence. You want to know why God is doing the things that He's doing? Why He's using the people that He's using? Be like, dude, why is He using that guy? You know, why is He using that dude? Because no flesh can glory in His presence if He uses the weak. If He used someone who had it all together, then people are like, well, that dude is awesome. That's why his ministry is being blessed and everything like that. But when He uses someone like me, you're like, dude, that guy's a wreck. You know? I have so many problems and sins in my life. When people look at me, I hope you guys just see, like, dude, God is so good and merciful and loving to use someone like that. If you'd have told me 2 years ago I would be standing here, I'd be like, nope, and I'd probably cuss to you because I used to cuss a lot back then. So in the Marines still. But but God is amazing. And He does beautiful things that you can never even understand. You know, we always sell Him short, though. We doubt because we see the fallacies of people around us, and we project that on God. God, you couldn't help them out. How are you going to help me out? Because He's God, and maybe His plan for you is different than them, and maybe if they would have just surrendered to His will in the first place, maybe they would be in a different place than they are right now. So instead of trusting in what I see, I trust in the things that are unseen. And that's what motivates me to go further. And that's a beautiful thing to understand. But notice He says, they did more wickedly than any of the people that were in the land before them. And if you read about the Canaanites that were in before them, you know how hardcore that is, that statement. These are people who used to heat up idols and put their newborn babies inside of them so that they can burn alive. These are people that used to set up poles and just have mass orgies around them all the time. And these are people who just like, man, they just killed people and they had orgies and they had just all the anything debaucherous that you could possibly think of in your mind of just being like, that would be so horrible. They did it. Infant sacrifice, child abuse, child molestation, almost like everything wrong that you could possibly think about. This is what these people were doing. Sadomasochistic, just dark, dark things. Everything wrong. And God says Israel's doing worse than what they were doing. The thing about being a Christian is when you fall, you don't fall softly. When you fall away, you don't fall softly. And the reason is this, because you have tasted of Jesus. You have tasted, if you grew up in the church, you have tasted at one point in your life the goodness of God. And you know how good that is. So then when you take the goodness of God and you replace it with something less, you have to go crazy into that thing to find any amount of satisfaction in your life. That's why when Christians fall, they fall hard, man. Because I'm now taking something fallen and temporal, and I'm trying to fit it where God was in my life. And that's why Judah, they're like, man, it's not enough to have the gods of the Amorites. We also have to have the god of the Jebusites. We have to have the gods of the Babylonians. We have to have the gods of the Syrians. We have to have everything. It's not enough for me to just watch porn. I also have to get into more deeper things. See, it's not enough. When I fell hard. See, I knew a lot of friends that had never even known God, and pornography was a problem in your life, but it wasn't like mine. It wasn't to the bondage point that mine was. It was just because they'd never tasted. See, to them, it was just recreational. See, now eventually, if fast forward a couple of years, you're going to see how many addictions those guys have and how much they're trying to fill because they realize there's something else out there because God has placed that God-shaped hole in your life. But when Christians fall away, I'm telling you, when you fall away, you will not stop at something light. You will go very deep and I see it happen all the time. The men that I counsel online, these are guys, if you read their testimonies, you'd be like, whoa, dude, this guy didn't just go a little. This guy didn't, he was like, dude, I'm going all the way, man. And they go really hard. I know one guy, I will share one testimony with you because you'll probably never meet this guy. He had a wife, was in the church, looked like a respectable guy in front of everybody, but he got into pornography. And eventually pornography didn't satisfy because he's living in this deception. You see, he's living in this deception of lust. And he's trying to fill things that God isn't satisfying anymore. And his wife isn't satisfying anymore. And all the things in his life aren't satisfying anymore. So he just keeps digging and digging into this hole. And then eventually he's like, man, porn's not enough. So I'm going to start having sex with other girls. So he started having sex with other girls, committing multiple adulteries on his wife. And then he's like, well, one girl isn't enough. So then he went into more debaucherous things. And eventually he contracted AIDS. And then he gave AIDS to his wife without her knowing. That's how she found out he was cheating on her. You'd think that was enough, wouldn't you? You'd think that's the wake-up call that you need, right? I have not heard from that guy in 6 months. I don't know where he's at. But I know he's not dealing with it. That's what I know. It wasn't enough. See, practice makes perfect. And as you get deeper and deeper into your sin, you will understand more and more and more how hard it is to get out, how hard it is to make a stand, how hard it is to fight. Because you have weakened yourself so much. That's why God tells you, don't even touch that stuff. Don't get near it. Don't ask yourself the question, how far can I go? Don't go there. That's the answer. Well, what if I just get a little buzz every now and then? Don't go there. Don't do it. Well, I mean, you know, weed just grows in the ground. What if I just stay there? It's not that bad. Just don't go there. Don't ask God, how far can I go? Well, how far can I go with my girlfriend before it's actually adultery? How far? And don't even go near it. Can a man take coal to his chest without being burned? That's what Solomon said. You can't handle it. You can't handle temptation. You can't handle sin. You're too weak. Don't go there. The question should never be how close can I get. The question should be how far away from that stuff can I get. Because I understand just how wicked it is. And I don't touch any of it anymore. Because I'm like, dude, I just want Jesus. And Jesus isn't there. And I just want His pleasure. I want to pour more into Him. I want to see how much more of my day could be taken up by the Word. How much more of my day could be spent amongst His body. How much more of my day could be spent encouraging and lifting other people up. Instead of how much more of my day can I spend on Facebook? And how much more of my day can I spend on video games? How much more of my day can I spend reading secular books and doing all these things that are not going to benefit me at all? It's not that those things are wrong. But if they're leading you from God, they are. The Christian life is one of amputation. Giving up the things you thought were important to pursue something better. And believe me when I tell you, all the things I've given up, it's worthless to me. I don't want it anymore. At the time I gave it up, I was like, man, that's a hardcore thing that God's asking me to do. Man, I could go anywhere in the country. I could live with any of my friends. I have the GI Bill. I have all this money. I could do whatever I want. And now I'm living in Tucson. But I was like, dude, but man, for the benefit of Christ that He's done in my life in these last years living here, I'm just like, man, thank you, God. You truly know best. You truly know best. I don't want any of those things. Anyone looking at my life would have been like, you're an idiot, dude. You're an idiot. You gave up everything to make $500 at a church. You idiot. Like, no, I'm not an idiot. God is just that good. God is that good. I would give everything up for Him. And then some. You know, that's the beauty of Him. They didn't understand, and that's why they were taken over. And your fall, as you fall, your fall will be so hard that those who hear of it, their ears will tingle. A judgment that God puts on your life is going to be so hardcore. And talk to a Christian who fell away. Talk to a Christian who fell away. They don't just go a little bit, man. They're just like, there is no effing God. And they're just so angry at everything that has to do with God. And my brother is just so, there's no God. I'm like, can you prove that to me? No, but there is no God. Well, are you happy where you're at? No, not.
Because life sucks, and then you die. And but they're just so angry at God. They're just so bitter. Your fall will be so great. The judgment on your life is going to be so great that everyone who sees it is going to glorify God's judgment. They're going to look at God and they're going to say, man, you are just what you did to that person. Instead of looking at your life, instead of glorifying His mercy in my life, and looking at God and saying, man, you are merciful. That's what I want to glorify. But I choose the lesser because I'm foolish. And that story that I shared with you of that man, that's God's judgment being glorified in that man's life. I see God and I say, man, you are sovereign and you see everything that happens, whether it's in the dark or in the light, and you're going to make all things that are in the dark known in the light. And I could glorify His judgment, but I should have wanted to glorify His mercy in that guy's life. But I can't. See, we should always want to glorify mercy. Don't you? Or do you want to glorify judgment? God always has a better plan for us. We should never try to talk Him out of it. Now, going down to verse 14, so I will forsake the remnant of my inheritance and deliver them into the hands of their enemies. And they shall become victims of plunder to all their enemies because they have done evil in my sight and have provoked me to anger since the day their fathers came out of Egypt, even to this day. Moreover, Manasseh has shed very innocent blood till he had filled Jerusalem from one end to another. Besides his sin, by which he made Judah sin in doing evil in the sight of the Lord. Now the rest of the acts of Manasseh and all that he did and the sin that he committed, are they not written in the book of the Chronicles of the Kings of Judah? So Manasseh rested with his fathers. Now there's a cool ending to Manasseh's story that you don't get in Kings, you get in 2 Chronicles. What ended up happening is God is like, dude, even in spite of everything evil you're doing, I love you. And I'm going to forgive you. I'm going to give you a chance to come back to me. So what he did is he brought the king of Assyria into Jerusalem, and it says he was taken by hooks. If you read anything about Assyria, you know they used to use fish hooks in people. And by the way, that's why VeggieTales, the fish slapping, that was a little joke. That was a joke to lighten what these people used to do. They used to take fish hooks and just stick them in your cheek and drag you. They would literally have people, like, they would tie it to horses. So when you're doing your death march back to wherever they're going to take you, it's just yanking on you the whole way. So you couldn't stop. You had to keep walking. It says they took him by hooks. So I mean, this dude probably had a hook shoved up his nose or something like that, taken all the way to Assyria. But it says when he was there, he cried out to God. He didn't cry out to the other idols that he was serving. Isn't it funny when something bad happens, you never hear anyone, how could Buddha do this? Man, Buddha sucks. You know, no one ever says that. It's always, how could God do this? Atheists say that. There's a just and loving God. How could he do this? Not how could the universe do this? How could God do this? In times of calamity, we always turn to God. In times of calamity, when I was in Afghanistan, it was funny how many friends came up to me and were like, dude, can you pray for me? How do I accept Jesus in my life? How do I do, and they do that? And then they come back and they're just like, oh, whatever. And they just go on with their lives. But when they're there, when they're staring death in the face, they're like, dude, I need something. I need something in here. You know, so he cries out to God. God, again, every right to just say no. Every right to turn his head. But instead, he had mercy on Manasseh. He forgave him, and he brought him back. He restored him fully. You look at a dude like that, so wicked. And the cool thing about it is we have a guy kind of like that in the New Testament. The Apostle Paul. So wicked that he was killing Christians. And yet, whenever I talk about the Apostle Paul today, everyone, no one's like, when I say that name, no one's like, oh, what a wicked dude. They're like, dude, what an awesome man. Even though he spent the majority of his life, not even, it was the minority of his life that God used him. It's kind of like Moses. The majority of his life he was running from God. It was only the last 40 years that God used him. The first 80, he was against God. See, it's not how you start a race. It's how you finish that really matters. Hezekiah started good, ended bad. And we remember the bad more than the good. Manasseh started horrible, but he ended good. It doesn't matter how far you go. It doesn't matter how far you get from God. There's no such thing as too far for him. That you, being rooted and grounded in love, may know the width and depth and height and length of the love of God for you. See, that's what the promise of Jesus is in my life. That I can understand there is no width. There's no length. There is no height. There's no depth of his love for me. There's no distance that's too far. It doesn't matter what sin I get into. It doesn't matter how deep I go into what I'm doing. It didn't matter how much I sinned against God. It didn't matter the fact that when I was 14, I didn't even believe He existed because I hated Him. It didn't stop Him from trying to save me, and it didn't stop Him from saving me. Every right to leave me where I was, and He didn't. That's how loving He is. And that's why I love Him so much. Man, I couldn't help but do anything but love Him who would love me that much. I couldn't help but do anything but be thankful for the one who called out my name when I was screaming at Him. And that is so intense and beautiful. Man, but the problem is that we get so deep into our sin when we finally come back. You may have like people in your life you can kind of think of when I say this. You become so bad that when you turn, no one believes it. Dude was so wicked that when they turned, that no one believes that they actually turned. Dude, there's no way that guy actually turned. Give it a year. This is just a fad. Then he's going to go away. He's going to go back to what he was doing. You know? You were so wicked that no one trusts that the change was legitimate. That's what happened to Manasseh. He started doing all these good things to try to get back. He was still rough around the edges, granted. And if you ever met someone who was like ex-Hells Angels or something like that, like ex-drug dealer, man, they're a little rough around the edges. But they got an awesome love for Jesus. Man, this dude was a little rough around the edges, but he was doing awesome stuff. But his son didn't focus on the good. He focused on the evil. He didn't focus on the last years where his dad confessed and repented. He's like, dude, you're a hypocrite, old man. And guess what happens when he sits on the throne? Ammon was 22 years old when he became king, and he reigned 2 years in Jerusalem, a whopping 2 years. His mother's name was Meshulameth, the daughter of Haruz of Joppa, and he did evil in the sight of the Lord as his father Manasseh had done. So he walked in all the ways of his father had walked, and he served the idols that his father had served and worshipped them. He forsook the Lord God of his fathers and did not walk in the way of his Lord. Then servants of Ammon conspired against him and killed the king and his own house. For those people of the land executed those who had conspired against King Ammon. Then the people of the land made his son Josiah king in his place. Now the rest of the acts of Ammon, which he did, are they not written in the book of the Chronicles of Kings of Judah? And he was buried in his tomb in the Garden of Uzzah. Then Josiah, his son, reigned in his place. Here we get a little hint that things in Israel are not all good. You have this wicked king. Somebody good rises up and they kill the guy. And instead of being like, yeah, dude, that's awesome. They killed the wicked king. Let's put a good one in spot. They're like, let's execute those dudes. They ruined our wickedness. And they're putting righteousness in here or something. And they get angry and they kill them. And then they put their son Josiah on the throne, who I believe was 8 when he started reigning. And he ended up being a really good king. Really good king. And but you see that like the people were already starting to indulge in wickedness. You see, God didn't judge the kings based on what... I mean, he didn't judge the people based on what the kings did. He judged the people based on what the people did. And the kings were part of that judgment. If I look in America, I can't be like, dude, the reason why we're so jacked up is because of Obama. The reason why we're so jacked up is because we're jacked up. And the fact that Obama's in office is definite proof that we're jacked up. We elected him. I mean, at least the people of Israel could be like, well, we didn't elect the guy. He was just, that was the dynasty he was in. We have no excuse. We clamor for people of wickedness now. The two people who are running, Obama and Romney. Romney's a Mormon. He was a Mormon. And I had many Christians be like, well, he's the lesser of two evils. Well, he's still evil, dude. He still believes in Mormonism. Have you looked up what they believe nowadays? Man, these people didn't even let African Americans into their temple until 1975. That's crazy, dude. And he was alive, an adult, when that happened. He didn't say anything bad about that. He wasn't like, man, the Mormon church, they really screwed up. No, he's like, no, I'm not going to speak against my church. Still wicked. Because we serve the God of Mammon. We don't care about who is most righteous. We care about who is going to fix my wallet. See, my God, my idol in America is money, fame, and decadence. That's what I serve. And I'm going to elect anyone who's going to promote that. Anyone who's going to give me more money, I'm into that. Anyone who's going to make my life a little more decadent, I'm into that. And honestly, ask yourself this question. If you had the ability to vote, would you vote for the person who was righteous, even if you knew for a fact he was going to be worse for our country in terms of economy and things like that? Or would you vote for someone who was pagan, but was going to do good things for the economy. I know how America's going to go because it's in Revelation. Guess what we're going to do? We're going to find a guy who's going to fix all of our economic woes. We're going to find a man who's going to give us health, wealth, and prosperity and everything that we clamor for. And his name's the Antichrist. And we are going to lift him up on our shoulders and we're going to say, who is like the beast, man? This dude's awesome. Most wicked dude ever to exist. And we're going to glorify him because the wickedness in our own hearts. See, Josiah makes a difference, but he doesn't change the people. It's all outward because we're wicked. God gives us every chance, gives us every opportunity to turn. It's not up to what the government does. It's up to you what you do. It's up to you how you're going to live. It's up to you how you're going to fight your flesh today. The future, you don't even know if you have it tomorrow. And you definitely can't change what you've done in the past. But you can choose today, man. I'm going to walk after Jesus today, man. I remember just like a couple nights ago, I was sitting in my car and like this thought came into my head. I was like, dude, this could legitimately be your last night. You know that, right? And like, even though I know it, do I really know it? Do I really act like it? If I knew that tonight was going to be my last night, would I view porn tonight? Heck no. No way. If I knew that tonight was going to be my last night, would I spend it watching TV and passing out early? No. Man, no. So I don't live like every night's my last night. But he's like, if this was your last night, what do you want to do? He's like, man, I just want to spend it with you. And I hope that my last day here, I'm just like praying to Jesus or something, and then I open my eyes and he's right there. I want to be so close to him, man, because any moment he could come back. Any moment. So I want to live my life like that. Any moment I could be in his presence, and I want to live my life like that. That's what's going to push me forward. Any moment I could open my eyes and he could be right there. And I want to be doing something glorifying to him when I do that, not something simple. And I could choose today to focus on Jesus. I could choose today to move forward. I'm not going to get perfect today. But man, I could move in that direction. I hope you guys make that decision in your life. All right, let's pray. Dear Father, I want to thank you so much for your word, God, and how beautiful it is, Lord, and how beautiful you are, God, that you would love fallen and sinful people like us, God, that you would give your life for us, Lord. I mean, how unbelievable is that? God, I praise you with everything that I am, Lord, and I pray that today would be a day that I could glorify you with everything that is within me, Lord. Thank you so much for your love and your goodness, Lord. May I be a conduit for that. May we all understand just how good and how perfect and how wonderful you are, that we may reflect that in our own lives, that people would see a difference and a change that you are making in us. May we put you first. In your name.